Good to see everybody here again today. Good to get to spend some time studying the Bible with you. We are in Job, and we almost finished chapter 37 last week, so we'll finish that up quickly this morning, and we'll get into chapter 38. I'm kind of expecting that we'll probably spend two lessons in chapter 38, because in this class, there's going to be a lot to talk about to try to frame some of the context and try to understand. Let's just try to put ourselves in that position and understand what we can, or try to learn what we can learn about why God is appearing to them and what it is he's trying to say. And then I think it'll pick up a little bit once we lay that groundwork. But we may spend a couple of classes in chapter 38. Just to recap from last week, when we study chapter 37, this is the final chapter that we have from Elihu's arguments. And in chapter 37, the first 13 verses, if you'll remember, Elihu personifies God in a storm, which is a little ironic, given about what's about to happen here in chapter 38, when God literally appears in a storm. Elihu, using this type of imagery, intends to serve the point that when God acts, man cannot react. That man is not going to be able to accomplish his purpose when God is working his purpose. So building on that, then, I present why I think Elihu seems to be arguing. He seems to go a step further to argue that it seems like he's saying everything that happens serves some purpose that God has assigned to it. And we discussed that it's true that things are happening that serve God's purpose that man can't see or understand. And it's the primary message of the whole book of Job, right? There's things going on that we don't see, that we don't understand. And it's also true that man's not going to be able to very effectively figure all that out just by observing what he can observe with the limited knowledge that we have. Man's not going to be able to understand everything because not all the information's been revealed to us. But we also talked about some problems with taking that line of thinking too far, in arguing that everything happens for a reason. Or as Elihu says in verse 13, whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. Those were Elihu's words. And we talked about how rather than believing everything happens for a reason, what we see often is God is accomplishing his will over competing forces. And God has the ability and the willingness to fix what is broken. And that's how we know we've seen God operate. But to say everything happens for a reason ventures into some dangerous territory, where now if God is causing everything to happen for a reason, then are we going to be like Job and perhaps blame God for some of these things that happen? And we use some examples of bad things that happen in this life and how God can take those bad things and cause good to come from them. But to stop short of saying that God caused that bad thing to happen so that the good thing would happen. And several examples, I think, defeat that line of thinking pretty easily. So we talked about that. And in verses 14 through 20 in chapter 37, we have Elihu speaking more to the greatness of God. And he rebukes Job again for wanting to speak with God in verses 19 through 20, which is what Job wanted to do. He wanted to have an audience with God where he could ask God, "Why are you doing this?" And he felt like if God saw him face to face, God wouldn't be able to answer him adequately. So Elihu rebukes him for that. And Elihu reminds Job that this is going to be a futile effort because it would be futile anyway, but much less for someone who has already asked for deep darkness, right? Which is what Job asked for in chapter 3. And that's interesting too, because I think when we get into chapter 38, we're going to see God respond to some of those things that Job said back in chapter 3. Some of the initial lament that Job went through, I think God's going to subvert in chapter 38. We talked a little bit about, you know, Elihu making mention of his hard cast mirror and the, you know, let's be careful about going to books of Job to try to argue that the Bible predates modern secular scientific thought. And we talked just for a minute, as we have in the past, that, you know, that's not the purpose of Job. That's not the purpose of many books of the Bible that we have. It's not a science book. If God had wanted to give us a science book on exactly how he did everything, then he would have, but he didn't. That's not what we have. He gave us something that's concerned primarily with other matters, with things pertaining to purpose and things pertaining to our relationship with him. And we talked about how, not to mention the fact that as it pertains to things like origin science and cosmology, what we now believe, at least in the secular scientific realm, is almost certainly incorrect, or it's at best terribly incomplete. And it's probably going to change. So you want to be careful about trying to reconcile things you have in the Bible with secular scientific thoughts and beliefs that could change. You don't want to reconcile the Bible to a shifting standard like that. So just some points. And I think that, again, that's going to be, I mentioned it last class. I don't want to beat that, you know, too much, but I mentioned it because I think we're going to be seeing some of that again in God's response. We're going to see God address Job and his friends at their level, in words and in ways that they could comprehend the message he was trying to give them. What he's not going to do is give them a physics lesson, right? He's not going to teach them how he did everything scientifically. But he is going to use examples of his creation to make points that he wants them to understand. So I think we're going to see that again, just for what it's worth. Yeah, Kelly, do you have something? There are bad things that are going to happen. That's the way it's always been. That doesn't mean that we just turn a blind eye to them. You know, we do what we can to try to help people who need help, specifically to try to do what we can to not let the general morality of society slip, but also understand where to draw a line when, and not to become too invested in this world. I think there's some wisdom to work out there like you're talking about. Understand that we ultimately have faith in God. God's will is not going to be thwarted. But
we'll just add to that. We want to point other people's faith in God, because their faith, having been invested in this world, where has it left them? You
know? Yeah, yeah. Let's not become too discouraged when things in this world don't work out the way we want them to, right? And even if it seems to be running contrary to what God wants, don't get too discouraged, right? So to finish chapter 37, we didn't read verses 21 through 24, but let's go ahead and do that now. Job 37, verse 21, it says, "And now no one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. Out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness. He will not violate. Therefore men fear him, because he does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." So the idea here, Elihu's finishing his statement, and he's been talking about these raging storms and these ice storms and snow, and after all that's passed, then the sky is clear. But, you know, even when the sky is clear, you have God personifying or being personified by the sun here in this example. And it's still somewhat of a distance between man and God. You know, even when man's not being shut down because God's accomplishing his will, we can't exactly stare directly into the sun either, right? So God, when he's working his will and it seems like there's nothing impeding us, there's still some gap there, I think, is the idea. And that, I think what Elihu's trying to say is, in all cases in life, through all seasons, God's ways are not obvious to a man in all cases, other than the facts that he is powerful and that he will be a good and capable judge, according to Elihu. And that, you know, I think the implication is we should be content in those things, and they should be securing to us. They should comfort us in whatever circumstance we might find ourselves in. And again, we've talked a lot as we've gone through Elihu's statements. I think Elihu is off in a lot of his applications because he has some bad assumptions about Job. And he thinks Job has done something to deserve this. But a lot of his points, if you kind of take them outside of that context, are really good. You know, he's making a lot of good points. So very interesting. And, you know, I can't help but to think of the irony of verse 24 when he says, "He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." When you go back to chapter 36 and verse 4, when Elihu claims, "For truly my words are not false, one who is perfect in knowledge is with you." Maybe there's a little bit of, compartmentalization there going on with Elihu. I'm not sure. But now we get into chapter 38. Okay, it's time for God to address them. And we'll go ahead and read the first three verses, and then we want to try to talk about the context of this discussion. So verses 1 through 3 says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, and said, 'Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me.'" So in verse 1, we see that God's appearing in a whirlwind. And this isn't to be understood as some little dust that got kicked up. Okay, this is a raging storm. This would have been something that would have been awesome and terrifying to see. Something very unnatural. This is a grand entrance. Okay, a grand entrance that God is making. And he is taking the attention off of the argument and onto himself when he appears this way. And you think about, just for a minute, and what I like to try to do is put myself in their shoes. Put yourself in the shoes of Job or one of his three friends or maybe Elihu. And you've been debating and debating and debating and debating, and now this happens. What would that have been like for you? I mean, would you have been comfortable? I would have been terrified. I would have been like, this just got real. I mean, we are now out of the intellectual, philosophical, speculative realm, and there he is. It just got real, right? So now, if that were me, I would be perhaps frantically racing through all the things I had said and thought, thinking like, is he about to strike me down? You know, there's probably some dread happening here, and I think you read into that in Job's responses to God. This isn't going to work out like Job envisioned it. Remember when Job wanted to call an audience with God, he envisioned himself standing before God. He realized he would be scared, but he pleaded if he could appear before him without dread, he could make his case and God wouldn't be able to answer him. It's not going to work out like that. That's not the reality. So something to think about, and how this idea isn't too distant from us, because it's going to be us one day, right? I mean, I have to think about it like that too. You know, this is going to get real, and it should be real, but it's going to get real when we see him as he is one day. We will be in his presence. And what is that going to be like? Hopefully it won't be terrifying to us. As to whom God is addressing. So verse 1 says, "The Lord answered Job." Okay, so there have been some who argue that chapters 38 and 39 are actually intended to rebuke Elihu. There is that interpretation out there. And then God turns his focus to Job then in verse 40, because you have a little bit of what seems like it could be a transition. In verse 40, it says, and the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." Like, so the idea would be that God is addressing Elihu, perhaps in 38, 39, and then when he's done clearing that up, then he turns to Job in chapter 40. So that's a plausible interpretation, but it's not where I'm at currently. And the reason I'm not there is primarily because I see in God's answers in chapter 38 and 39, there's so much that connects back to things that Job said, that it's hard to pass it off as coincidence. It sure seems like God is giving Job a direct answer to some of the things that Job himself spoke. But if it is the case that he's answering Elihu, then that interpretation would argue that God is first setting in order the things that Elihu had spoken wrongly, and by extension, Job's friends as well, I think. And it would be a response to anyone presumptuous enough to claim to be speaking for God, which Elihu did. He did claim to speak for God. And, you know, I think that that rebuke would make a lot of sense in this context. But again, it's not where I'm at for other reasons. You would also have to take verse 1 and interpret it as more of a generic statement and not as plainly as it seems to be stated that God answered Job, right? I mean, verse 1 says he answered Job. But you would have to interpret that as something as though then the Lord appeared on account of Job and the events that had transpired, and then he said, and then went into a statement. So it would be like, well, he answered Job. Job would have to represent kind of the generic arguments that have been flying around, okay? So there's a little bit of disconnect there as well. But some people take that view. So that view is out there, just so you know. Again, I lean towards the more traditional view that God is, in fact, addressing Job directly. But I think it's also apparent that he does intend to address Job's friends as well. Because at the end of his rebuke, when Job repents, God turns to his friends and says, "You've not spoken to me the things that are right like my servant Job has." So it's apparent that God intends for not just Job to hear this message and internalize it, but also for his friends to do it as well. So there is a broader audience that I think God is addressing here, and not just Job. So let's talk a little bit about the tone of God's message. These verses may seem uncomfortable because it kind of looks like, at least on the surface, that God is now shaming this poor man whom he's caused to endure so much suffering, that now he's just going to dump on him and say, "Who are you?" You know? And I think that some people have gotten stuck on this tone that they read into what God is saying. So I wanted to offer some thoughts about that. And again, I would call us to not lose sight of the context. What we have here leading up to this is Job and his friends have spoken quite at length about many of the wondrous things that God does. They have also often called to attention how powerful God is, how mighty he is, how much authority he has, calling into action all of his works of creation, how he sustains the world and cares for it, and all these things that God does. That's been a frequent go-to for everybody who's been arguing here. And that's great. That's all well and good to give God honor for those things. But from what I gather about the way God is replying, Job and his friends had used those observations to serve their own arguments, which happened to be incorrect in one form or another. On the account of Job's friends, they were incorrect because they were built on some faulty assumptions about why these things were happening to Job. And on Job's account, he believed that God, for some reason, has now become his enemy and wasn't going to relent. So they had incorrect understandings of what was going on, but they were using how God acts and what God does to support their own incorrect arguments. So taking it a step further, not only did they presume to know things about which they didn't to support their own incorrect arguments of what was happening, but it wasn't just about trying to make sense out of a thing. It was about using what God does and how God thinks and how God acts as ammunition against each other. So it wasn't just they had a misunderstanding about what was happening, but they were using that information to attack each other. Like, because God works in this way, you're condemned. He thinks this about you. So it took it even a step further. And, you know, you could argue that on the most basic definition of the word profanity, they were guilty of a type of profanity. They had taken things that were holy and they had used them for their own human reasons and their own human ways to accomplish their own human motives. So with that in mind, I understand God's response, especially in chapters 38 and 39, is he's going to address that problem first. You get a sense of this right off the bat in verse 4. He's going to go right to those things that he did, right? In verse 4, he says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." He's going to get that straightened up right away. And the point is, like, of course, a lot of rhetorical questions are about to follow. The point is, you weren't there, right? None of you were there. None of you were there to see God do all these things. So why are you speaking as if you were? Why are you using this in your arguments like you know what was going on so well that you can make those applications to your own arguments and use them for your own benefits? You know, what right do you have to argue against each other on the basis of how I do things? I think is the idea behind the rebuke that's coming here. And again, thinking about God's tone, we consider how terrifying this must have been to Job and his friends to witness. It was definitely spectacle, definitely something that would have locked your attention when you saw this storm appear and start speaking to you. But it's going to quickly expose those things that I had or they had, you know, if I were putting myself in their shoes, spoken in error. Having presumed to know things about God's mind that he hadn't revealed to them. So again, I mentioned this, but if I were there, I would be worried, like, is he about to, like, end it? You know, I mean, what's about to happen to me here, right? There would have been that dread, I think. But what you get instead is you don't get, well, what you do get is you get a God who is demonstrating power. He appears in the storm, and he is going to demonstrate that he has a right to condemn. But you also get a God who's going to speak in a way that shows he is willing to persuade. He's willing to speak with them about this, and he's going to make an argument. He's not there to strike them dead. He's there to make an argument, and he's there to convict and to persuade. You were wrong. Here's why. His tone needs to be stern if he's going to express his displeasure with what's been said, and I think that he is not pleased with what has been spoken about him. But this isn't about him being petty. It's not about him being taking a sassy tone, you know, or anything like that. But he's here to make things right. He's not there to give them a free pass, but he's there to make things right. He's there to start this restoration process. And I think that we got to be careful when we read into this that he's not just there to just dump on Job. That's not the point. So understand that this is in itself an act of mercy, as I see it. This is an act of mercy that he is there to talk to them, to persuade them that they were wrong, and to fix that, and so we can all move forward. Because that's the ultimate goal, and that's how it ultimately plays out. That's what he was there to do. So we see that God is terrifying, but God is merciful. And God cares about setting things that were wrong into the right. He wants to make wrong things right. He's not indifferent about the wrong things. He's not, in as much as he's not there to strike them dead, he's also not there to say, you know, how could you have known? He's not there to just completely give them a free pass at everything they've said. He's going to rebuke them, he's going to convince them, and he's going to set things right. So he's there to show, and it's funny how you start seeing this theme with God appear throughout the whole Bible. I think that this is not an uncommon theme, that you find God is one who is going to be merciful. He doesn't want anyone to perish, like 2 Peter chapter 3 says. He wants all to come to repentance. This is very consistent with God's character. And he's showing himself by this demonstration to be a capable and righteous judge. He's merciful, but he's capable of like, if you don't repent, he's capable of punishing you. And your terror would be justified in that case. But he's showing himself to be a capable and righteous judge and one who is invested in their affairs. Again, he's not indifferent. What if God had just said, man, that's so messed up. I'm not even going to go there. Just let them do their thing. And that's not what he did. He came down and spoke with them and tried to set them right and convince them of their error. So let's understand it for what it is in the context of all that. And let's not just say, why is God being so, why is he dumping on this poor guy that went through so much suffering? Well, let's understand that I think this is an act of mercy in and of itself. but that God needed to demonstrate his displeasure with them as well. So let's talk for a minute about the content. Again, we're setting the stage for God's response. As we mentioned earlier, I think what you're going to have here in God's response is he's going to be addressing them on their level. God is going to be using concepts that they would understand, and he's going to be using them so that he can make the points he wants them to get. He's not going to burden them, like I said earlier, with a physics lecture on how things like gravity and light work, right? That's not why he's there. If he'd wanted to do that, he probably could have, but he's not there to do that. And again, I don't want to get off on a tangent every time, but let me just remind you real quick that modern secular science does not have a very good understanding of things like gravity and light either. They know a lot more than Job and his friends would have known, a lot more, but there's a lot of things about how light behaves and a lot of things about how gravity and the forces work like that that are still a little bit of a mystery to us that don't quite work in our modern understanding of them. So just know that those are still things that are being understood even now, all these years later. So God's going to address them on their level. Another wrinkle we have to give consideration to is the fact that this is still part of the poem. Job's response is still fitting the structure, the greater structure of the book of Job, which is a poem. And we talked way back in the first couple of classes, you know, 6-7 months ago, whenever it was, about some of those poetic devices that you find in the book of Job. So you have to give consideration to the fact that it's possible, but it seems unlikely to me that God would have spoken to Job and his friends using the exact poetic language that fits the structure of everything else in this book. It's possible that he did, and it's possible, I suppose, that when Job debated with his friends, they used all this poetry when they went back and forth, just on the fly, spontaneous poetry, which has been looked at now for the past several thousand years as being like a supreme example of ancient poetry. That they could generate that on the fly is difficult for me to take. But God's response also fits this. So what do we do with that? Well, the way I work through that is I have faith that God preserved this for a reason. And he preserved it because it correctly represented his take on what was going on with Job. It's there for us, and I think we can take this to the bank, that we're getting access to what God thought about all of this. Okay, I have faith that that's the case, that the concepts have been preserved so that maybe we hesitate to say that he came out speaking in a poem. I think the concepts we can take to the bank, and that's just something to think about, okay? Just something for you to consider. One last observation, and then we'll get into a little bit of the text this week, and then I think we'll probably go a little bit faster once we lay this groundwork. I mentioned before about how God is about to make it real for them, and he's about to make the creation real. He's going to take them back and use examples of things that really happened and say, like, did you know that happened? Did you know that happened? Did you know who did that? So he's about to make that real. I want to just point out, as we get into it, that the creation account, let's not think of it as just this event that we can go back to use and bolster our own arguments and understandings of things that happen. Maybe the largest understatement I've ever said, but creation was a big deal. It was a big, big deal. It was a big deal to God, and it was a big deal to the host of heaven, such that when all the host of heaven saw the creation, they rejoiced over it. It was a big deal. We aren't just some pet project that God had this itch to do one day and then put it on the shelf because it got kind of worn out on him. The creation was a big, big deal. And what's happening now as part of his creation is a big deal, even if we don't see it all clearly. It's a big deal. Like, our lives matter. I think that's something we should take from this. You know, in a sense, the fact that God appears to Job and his friends to rebuke them, it proves their value to him. Again, because he showed up. He showed up to talk to them. You know, in God's eyes, this is worth the time and the effort. This is worth him showing up. some of the things God's about to say, talk about his provision for his creation. And we're to understand that when God's rebuking Job and his friends, that God cares for his creation. He loves it and he provides for it. That's how he operates. So just some groundwork to be laid. If you have any questions about that, let me know and we can talk about that. But all things that I felt were helpful to try to think through and try to set our minds right before we get into the text, because I don't want us to read this as like, well, now God's just dumping on Job. I don't think that's it at all. Let's keep the context in mind, okay? Verses 4 through 7. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? So God begins by speaking about the foundation of the world. And again, this is language they could understand. Does the earth have a literal cornerstone by which all of its measurements were determined? When you think of a cornerstone, we think of something that stretches out indefinitely on a plane, right? As setting the measurements. He's using language they understand because that's how they build, right? They would start with a cornerstone and they would build. God's talking about when I was building, okay? So he's using language they understand. You know, it's interesting to think is when he says in verse 5, he said, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Wouldn't the natural answer be, well, you did. We know who did that. Right? You did, God. But he's asking them rhetorically like they weren't there, so they don't know. Isn't that kind of interesting? How the point is he's making in the rhetorical question is like, you don't know who did that. That's kind of interesting to me. And I don't want to go too far off into this, but I just want to use it in the context of Job and the greater lessons of Job is let's be careful about what we presume to know. Because there could be more going on that we don't know. Very much like what the book of Job is trying to teach Job. You know, we just don't have a lot of knowledge about everything that happened. And I will say that I had previously and often assumed that when God spoke things into existence, then they existed immediately and spontaneously. And I don't know that that's an incorrect interpretation at all. But is there an assumption there that I'm bringing to that interpretation that may be a little bit wrong? Well, when you have verses talking about like, hey, who measured this out? As a rhetorical question to Job and his friends, like, you don't know. Well, that makes me question that a little bit. Maybe I am bringing an assumption. And maybe when God spoke it, it was executed. But how it was executed, I don't know. I don't know that it spontaneously appeared. I don't know. I wasn't there. And I have to be comfortable with that answer, that I don't know everything about how that happened. I can't go and make a theological point to somebody and say when God speaks, it instantly happens because I wasn't there to witness it. I don't know exactly how that was executed. It's possible it was executed that way, but maybe not. Maybe there are other beings that were carrying these things out for God. It makes me think about John chapter 1, how all things were created through the Word. Right? So we know that the Son had some role in creation. What was that role exactly? I don't know. To further muddy the waters, if you look in Genesis chapter 1, every time the word God is used, it's used in the plural. That's uncomfortable to me. That it's Elohim, plural. And yet, to add even more confusion, a lot of the verbs that are conjugated in Genesis chapter 1 are conjugated as a singular person acting. So now you have this tension between is it many or is it one? And Genesis isn't overly clear. And people have debated this for thousands of years. I'm not going to be able to put it together in 5 minutes and get it right. Have a little humility here, right? Once you start understanding some of these tensions that exist, it's like, hey, maybe I don't know as much as I thought I did. Lots of things have been written and things have been said and studied about God's locality. Like, where is God exactly? You know, when God visited Abraham, for example, was God in Abraham's tent or was he on his throne in heaven? I don't know how that works. Did he abandon his throne to go visit Abraham? I don't know. But the point is, like, let's be careful about presuming that we can answer all those things in a way that now we'll go to people and say, here's how it is, right? Let's be careful. There's a lot going on here about even God's locality and where he is that is beyond me. I don't understand it very, very well. Yeah, Kelly?
I was going to say, I was reading the part where you were talking about the cornerstone. I was thinking to myself, maybe God's point is making to them, perhaps, you need cornerstones. I don't need one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm the cornerstone. And you can't do this because it's not in your understanding.
Yeah.
And I think we get caught up, but we've got to figure out how God did this. We actually don't have to figure that out. We can still marvel at the greatness of everything he's done without understanding a thing about ours.
What do we know about what's God's point? What is God's point to Job right now? You don't know. You weren't there. Let's hear that. That's all I'm saying. Let's hear that message. Okay? We know more than Job did, but let's hear that. Yes, Britt? Which he has in the past. He's shown up as a visitor before.
Exactly.
Right?
So what his point this time is to remind them, I'm God. Now, I don't know whether that's a rebuke or not. I don't know if he's rebuking Job. I don't know if he's angry at Job. Because the initial start of Job was, have you considered Job? He gives Job an awful lot of credit. He does. And now he's at the point where it says, okay, Job, you need a quick reminder. I'm God.
Yeah.
And all of his friends, they need the same reminder.
Yeah.
Because they didn't understand.
Yeah, I believe that that God thinks very highly of Job. I think that didn't necessarily change. We get his opinion of Job, his very high esteem of Job, like you said, in the first couple of chapters. But I do think Job messed up. I think that he presumed to know things he didn't. I think that that's what he literally says he repents of when you get to the end of this. And I do think that God is rebuking him and his friends with him for those things. But again, not for the purpose of just condemning him, which is, there's so much going on here. Like, I mean, Job had reached the point of despair to where he just wanted to be covered in darkness. Remember, he that's what he was asking for in chapter 3. He said, just throw me into the deep of the ocean. Let darkness cover me. You know, let the grave be my bed. That he wanted to be basically just dead and separated from God, and that's not what God wants for Job. He doesn't want Job dead. He doesn't want Job separated from him. But he's here to remind him, you know what? You're deathly terrified of whatever this creature is I'm talking about. Sounds like a dragon to me in chapter 41. You're deathly afraid of this creature, this Leviathan that you would draw out of the ocean. Would you try to use him as your play toy and bring him before, you know, your kids and let them play with him like you would some pet? No, you're scared of that thing. So why aren't you scared of its maker? Why don't you show me the proper reverence and fear? Why are you talking about me like I'm just some tool to be used in your own arguments? Let's hear that message. Let's keep that proper respect and fear for God. And I know there's more to be said about the story and about our relationship with God. It doesn't begin and end with fear. But that's foundational, and I think the Bible's clear about that. That's the beginning of knowledge, right? The fear of God is the beginning of knowledge. That's where it begins. This is foundational stuff that God had to relay with Job and his friends. You've forgotten your fear of me. You're speaking things presumptuously, and you shouldn't be. It is definitely a rebuke. So let's do our best to keep our own assumptions in check. Let's challenge our understanding of the scripture and try to just parse, like, okay, what am I assuming upon the text? And then let's keep that part in check. It doesn't mean we're wrong, and it doesn't mean that sometimes it's necessary to understand what's happening. Like, you have to just inherently fill in some of the gaps to make what you're reading coherent and relevant to you. But let's just be careful before we go to other people and say, that's how it is. And let's not use it to attack other people, because that's what I think we saw Job and his friends doing to each other. Presuming things and then using it as ammunition against each other. We are out of time, so we'll pick up next week in verse 8, and we will keep moving. Thank you so much for your attention.